During the next few days, I stayed out as much as possible and did not answer my phone when it rang. I wanted time alone to think things over and to decide what to do next. My faith in Duncan had been shaken, yet the thought of a complete break left me breathless and frightened. I thought a lot about Katrina, how she would have disapproved of what I had become involved in, calling it a waste of time, or worse. In the end, I grew tired. I could not justify my behavior in ignoring Duncan. Had he not treated me with extraordinary kindness? I went back to my flat and rang him at his office. He did not ask where I had been, did not say he had been trying to get in touch with me. "I'm glad you rang when you did," he said. "Are you free this evening?" I said I was. He had not needed to ask. "Excellent. You may remember that when we first talked about your studies, I said I would introduce you to some friends of mine, people further along the path than yourself. I think the time has come. Get yourself ready for 7 o'clock. I'll pick you up." He drove me to Claremont Place. A church tower came in sight before we reached our destination, high, lifted up above the roofs, tall and black, as though light had never touched it. Duncan parked on the opposite side of the street. At first glance, it seemed that the church was derelict, that it had not been in liturgical or other use for some time. And yet, for all its neglect, the building had lost none of its power. It had been designed to communicate a sense of religious awe, and that remained, in the sheer scale with which it towered over the passer-by. But it possessed something else, a sense of brooding evil, so overpowering that it took the breath away. From the outside, not a fragment of light was visible through the boarded-up windows. Entering, I saw that candles had been lit in tall sconces along the aisles and in the chancel. Ahead of us, gathered at the chancel end, was a group of half a dozen figures wearing hoods. Duncan introduced us one at a time. I saw at once that they had several things in common. They were all men. They were all successful and fairly wealthy. Bankers, insurance brokers, broadcasting executives. And they all belonged to the same class as Duncan. Not one of them had a Scottish accent. I asked myself again why Duncan took such an interest in me. "Andrew," he said, "this evening I'd like you just to sit and watch. Do you mind?" I shook my head. There was a chair near the choir stalls, and I sat down, glancing nervously round me at the swaying shadows. On my right, there was a heavy door. I knew it must lead to a subterranean crypt. I noticed that it was not wholly shut. Duncan looked at his watch. "Gentlemen, I think we should begin." He took a robe from the cupboard and put it on. The altar had been removed from the chancel, and a large pentacle painted in the space it had occupied, framing a red circle. Duncan stepped into the centre of this arrangement. The others pulled their hoods up and stood in a circle along the perimeter. Duncan began to chant in Arabic. His friends responded in the same language, and I recognised from snatches that they were using the text from which I had been taught by Sheikh Ahmad in Fez. The longer they chanted, the more sonorous grew their voices, the more controlled and purposeful their gentle swaying movements. The stone walls echoed to the carefully modulated rhythms of the chant. The Arabic words rolled through the church, calling, summoning, imploring. "Come," they chanted, "come. Make haste and come among us. Come, we are waiting, we are waiting. Come." And something came. Their movements slowed, their breathing steadied, their voices deepened. They knew that a presence had come among them. Petrified, I felt it. Duncan's voice rose again and again, a note of triumph in it now. I heard a slithering sound behind me. Unable to stop myself, I looked round. The door of the crypt had moved. The sound was coming from behind it, and as I watched, something thin and white appeared in the gap. I could bear it no longer. frightened beyond measure. I leapt from the chair and ran down the nave. No one stopped me. Behind me, the voices continued uninterrupted. Come, they chanted. Come. I reached the door and ran outside and kept on running. But the voices would not leave me, however far I went. Duncan rang me the following morning, apologetic. I should not have taken you, he said. I thought you were ready, but clearly you need more preparation. Now try not to worry about what happened. It's part of growing in the craft. You have yet to learn how to dominate your fears, how to prevent them taking over and colouring what you see and hear. We talked for a little, Duncan explaining his theories about the power of mind over place, but I did not believe him. I could no longer believe in his high-mindedness. I could not take a step further down the path on which he was leading me. But I did not know how to break away. It was Duncan himself who gave me the opportunity. Andrew, he said, I have to go away for a week or so. We'll talk properly when I come back. I'll give you a ring. Fine. I'll see you when you get back. But I had already decided what to do. I would not be there when he returned. I found a small flat in Toll Cross. It was much cheaper than my current rooms, but better than that, it was well away from Duncan's normal haunts in the old town. I moved to my new lodgings the next day. As soon as I closed the door, I felt almost giddy with relief. I had been in my new quarters a week when I admitted to myself that it was time to visit Harriet. She had been much on my mind since my return, but until now I had been almost paralysed by my feelings of guilt about Ian's death. My newfound rationality scattered all such notions, and I telephoned right away. There was a long silence when she heard my voice, as though I were someone she had thought lost or dead and never expected to hear from again. I got your letter, I said. I rang from Fez, but you were away. I'm back in Edinburgh. Can I come and see you? She paused, and for a moment or two I thought she was about to say no. But I was mistaken. She wanted to see me. There were things she had to talk with me about. Could I come that afternoon? Harriet was waiting for me with tea and cake, just like the old days. But she had changed. Her face was thinner, and there were grey streaks in her hair that had not been there before. More striking was the alteration in her manner. The brightness that had once impressed and cheered me had dimmed, and I was left with an abiding sense of sadness. She looked at me. It is all over, isn't it? Milne and everything. I hesitated. I had not really thought about it in such stark terms. But now the question had been put directly, I realised that was just how matters stood. She lifted the pot and poured two cups of tea. How did it happen? I asked. With Ian. You said very little in your letter. There was little enough to say. It started a day or two after he went to visit you. He came back that evening quite upset about what was happening to you, about this man Milne. He'd asked around a bit, found out things about Milne that he didn't like. Anyway, a couple of days after seeing you, he had the most blinding headache. Nothing had the least effect on the pain. In between the headaches, he wrote a long letter to you. He never let me see what was in it, but he told me several times it was vital you read it. What about this letter? Did he finish it? I don't know, she said. If he did, I haven't been able to find it. Could he have posted it to me? Well, that's possible. Early on, he was still going out in between bouts of illness. It was only later that he was forced to stay indoors. They took him into the Royal Infirmary at the end. That's where he died. It was a very painful death, she said without apology. Even with sedation, he suffered a great deal. The post-mortem results were ambiguous. Whole sections of his brain were scarred, but they could find no cause for the injuries, no obvious agent. But it's over now. Knowing won't bring Ian back. That same evening, I made my way to a call box and dialed home. My father came on the line. He asked me about my job. I told him I was waiting for something else to turn up. "Look," he said, "would you have any objection to my coming to visit? I have some leave due, and I could be with you next week." My first impulse was to say no, but I checked myself. Why not, after all? It would be good for me to see my father. I badly needed a dose of his unshakable skepticism. "Yes," I said, "I'd like that very much. Why don't you both come? I can't put you up, but there are plenty of guest houses round here." I gave him my new address. I was already looking forward to his visit. "Andrew, before you go, there's one wee thing I have to mention. While you were away, a man from Glasgow City Council got in touch. He'd been trying to contact you. Did he ever get in touch?"
"No."
"Well, he'd like you to ring him sometime. His name's Logan. I have his number here."
"Do you know what it's about?"
"Well, he wouldn't tell me, but I think it's to do with Katrina's grave. I have a feeling it's been vandalized." Jamie Logan worked for the Parks and Cemeteries Division of the Council. I rang him the next morning.
"Dr. McLeod, I'm so glad you finally got in touch."
"What's it about?" "My father thought it might be to do with my wife's grave." There was a silence of several seconds during which he assumed his official manner.
"Yes," he said, his voice lower now and more solemn. "That's correct. There's been..."
I heard him hesitate. Imagined him choosing his words carefully.
"There's been some trouble. Has our headstone been vandalized? Is that what you're trying to tell me?"
"Well, as a matter of fact, no. It's worse than that. Our grave was dug up one night in August. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but your wife's remains have been stolen."
The incident had taken place on the night of the 19th of August. The next morning, on arriving to start their day's work, gravediggers had found the grave opened and the coffin gone. I knew that Duncan could not have been personally involved, but he had friends whom he might have persuaded to carry out something of the kind. All I knew was that the 19th of August was the day I left Fez for Marrakesh, the day after my last session with Sheikh Ahmad. I remembered my words to him on that occasion. "Katrina is dead. Her body is in a grave, rotting." Early the next morning, I woke, screaming. I was lying in my bed, the sheets twisted as though in a frenzy. My body was caked with sweat and I was shivering. I pulled the blankets around me and huddled against the pillows, trying to get warm. Thin sunlight struggled through my window. I could hear cars outside and the voices of excited children playing hopscotch. A dog barked at the end of the street. An aeroplane passed slowly overhead. My heartbeat began to slow. But something in the room was wrong. And then, just as I had decided that it was all imagination and was preparing to get out of bed, I knew what it was. I could smell perfume. It was faint, but unmistakable. I knew its name at once. Juki. It had been Katrina's favorite scent.